Welcome everyone to Umra Reads. We're going to talk about the book, The Phone Booth at the Edge of the World. Anyone like to volunteer to comment first?
Well, I really liked it. I read it in one day. I thought it was very, very interesting way for someone to handle some grief. And I thought it was very interesting the way they worked the characters around and how I can't remember her name because it's been a month since I read it.
Yui, I think.
Yeah. And that she went there so many times. And finally, on the last one, she was able to pick up the phone. But such tremendous grief that she had. And it reminded me about the tsunami. I mean, you know, it's kind of like we've pushed it out of our minds. It's been 12 years. And it's like, you know, you don't even think about it happening very much. And I can't imagine all the grief that all those people went through with what was happening and heard their descriptions of what was in the book. I thought it was a very, very interesting, good book. I thought it was well worth reading.
Yeah, I think the way that she described Yui's grief was really informative and a harsh reminder of what devastation occurred and the little vignettes of other people whose grief, you know, she found out about and who had gone to the phone or not, that really did remind us of the tragedy that brought on. And I found it to be such an easy read too. You know, it's just so easy, and she broke it up nicely with these little lists and things, the importance of which, I guess, you know, there are notes in the back of the book to spark discussion, and that was one of them. What was the purpose, and what did we think about the list? And I'd like to hear people's opinions about that, because I don't know, they're kind of marginal for me. Maybe I missed something as to what I was supposed to extract from that. But then the way she handled and worked through her own grief, and you know, the question of whether it's about grief or about joy is a good one, because it ends up, the ending is happy. And so that made me feel good too.
Yep.
It had a lot of good kind of quotes in it, or that I wrote down. I thought I'd maybe just read a few of them. That, I mean, it's a book I never would have picked up on my own. So it's like a lot of them with our club. You know, I wouldn't have probably picked it up, but I also, it was the easiest read I think we've had. I mean, I couldn't put the book down either. I'd read it in some really short period of time. I found the characters interesting, and I actually thought it was, I mean, what a neat idea of a way to help people that are grieving for one reason or another, to say, well, you know, you can still talk to those people. You know, you go to this park in a nice serene setting, at least when it's not having tsunamis. It's a nice serene park, and you can go there and talk to a relative or somebody that's passed away. I just thought, well, that wouldn't be such a bad idea. In fact, I have a historic phone in our house that I bought, or that was given to me as a gift. I thought, shoot, maybe I should just pick it up and talk to somebody. I haven't done that yet, but I thought, well, that's not a bad idea. I'm not grieving at the moment, so I don't think I need to do that. But just real quickly, you know, I thought some really interesting sayings of, you know, smile with your heart, not your mouth. Superficial knowledge of a subject might be more harmful than having complete ignorance. sleep cures all. That isn't always the case, because you get nightmares, but love is dangerous, but it's essential. And then the idea of looking through a frame and focusing to help you focus on something, I thought that was interesting. And then pain gives life depth. So, if it, everything that's what I've always said about, maybe living in, well, living in your Florida where it's always sunny. I mean, well, you don't appreciate the sun because it's always sunny. If you don't have some pain in your life, you don't appreciate, the other things. So I don't know. Those were a few that I wrote down. I just thought was were kind of interesting things to think about.
Yeah, I found myself underlining several lines or even paragraphs in the book as well. Let me repeat one that I liked a lot and I just found in the book again. This was early in the book when she first meets Takeshi. And it says both of them felt they had somehow been found, like two objects stuck together by chance at the bottom of a handbag. I thought that was pretty
Yeah,
funny.
just little right, just things like that. I mean, just what a creative writer. And I got a lot of out of the book in a lot of a lot of different ways. And it ended up the end kind of ended up being a love story. And this more of the second half of the book, but the how these families could fit together and deal with a child that was somebody else's and finding a way to love that child like your own. I thought that was it was a lot of it was certainly a happy ending type of thing.
Well, the trepidation she felt about it ahead of time, and
Yeah.
but it did resolve, so that was, contributed to the happiness of the ending.
I was thinking for a while about what it is about the mechanism of that phone that frees people up to talk in a way that they might not have otherwise, just like being at home or whatever. And it just feels like it gives a layer of protection or something that or a layer of safety or something. I can't even really describe it that okay, I know how to do this. I know how to talk on the phone, maybe at home to talk to my dead mother or dead daughter or whatever. I don't know how to do that. And it's funny that it's such a universal thing to so many people who found comfort by going there. Please don't print, Richard. Okay. So that, and then also the picture frame idea to look at things. It's funny, it sort of reminded me when my daughter was much younger, she was competing in horse shows. And sometimes when I'd go to watch her, and as it got higher level competition, it was kind of nerve-wracking. And to sit there and watch was really nerve-wracking. But if I took my camera and was like videoing and was sort of watching it on the camera instead of looking at the arena, I felt I was able to do that a little more. It's like weird. It was like I was watching, well, I was watching a picture of it, and I realized it was kind of stupid and crazy, and I could just look up and see it, but it felt like it sort of brought the nerves down a little. I don't know if it was sort of a layer of stepping back a step or something like that. So I was thinking maybe, the talking on the phone, the looking through the frame, those were just interesting concepts of trying to get your grief out or to start the communication. So that's it. It was
I could hear
interesting that
you.
some of them were not like the young man whose father that she found they found out later on he was not deceased.
Right.
And how the young man was grieving for that father, for that relationship. And so it's the loss was lots of people having a loss, of different kinds. And the gentleman whose wife had died from the tumor that she fell in love with, it was his daughter not talking. that brought him there, not his wife's death. And I thought that was interesting too, so that the phone, you worked for different things than just somebody who was grieving over the death or from the tsunami.
Did that little girl start talking again? I can't remember.
Yep, you bet.
Yes, she did.
She said mother, did she?
No, no, that was the son, the later
son.
Oh,
okay, okay.
Stephanie, you're muted. We can't hear you. I see your lips moving, but I can't hear you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Hmm. Oh, no.
It shows you muted. Now try again.
No, unmute it.
Okay, maybe turn up your volume. Still can't hear you. No.
We can hear you earlier.
Yeah, we heard you earlier.
Check your microphone settings, maybe.
I've had that happen in Zoom meetings before, is that people, you know, all of a sudden you can't hear, and they're not muted or anything. You just can't hear them.
Oh.
Stephanie, it might help to sign out and then sign back in again.
Yeah.
Assuming you're actually talking and not just mouthing words.
Good. We can use it to practice our lip reading if you want.
Yes.
Right.
This many.
Maybe she can call us on an old phone. And...
I like the idea that there is a real one there.
Yeah.
Kind of based on a true story.
Uh-huh.
Well, on a fact rather than a story, I guess. But I like that idea.
Yeah, in the end note, she says that it does exist, but admonishes us not to go there as tourists to find it. Mm-hmm. But then she also admits she hadn't been, and that all of this was based on her perceptions of what it would be like. Mm-hmm. So that's pretty good, because she painted a right. pretty good picture, I'd say.
Right, she did.
I passed my book along to others because I enjoyed it so much, but I'm missing having it here to talk with.
Actually, Cindy's got it up in Bay City right now. So yeah, I don't have the book in front of me. I usually take some notes when I read the things that I want to remind. So I had the notes, but she's got the book and she's already ready to pass it on to her sister to read because she's enjoying it also.
It's a shareable book for sure.
It is.
Yeah, turn up though. Your volume's low.
Okay, now can you hear me?
There you go.
Yeah.
Yes, good. Yeah.
I think it is such a pretty book. I have the hard copy and I like the way it's set up. I like the small drawings at the start of each chapter. I like the paper. I like everything about it. I like the cover. And I thought that it was kind of this gentle book. I mean, it was about a crushing situation, but somehow as this story evolved and, you know, through all that pain, she came out on the other side and it's a part of her, but she's able to still experience joy. And I do think that at our age, we've all had losses. And maybe not through a tsunami and not a mother and child at the same time and all of this, but I think there is something there that in some small way we could relate to. And I had a friend who lost her daughter in a unexpected way in her 30s. And I suggested about this book, and she really thought it was great, and it's kind of a portrait of grief and grieving, and I think their pilgrimage to that place is kind of part of it, and the way that man had this beautiful landscaping and set the phone in a sort of a beautiful situation was another kind of part of it. But I don't know if any of you have thought about, you know, being able to just talk to someone who's gone now who meant a lot to you. But, you know, it's kind of occurred to me, and when I read this, And I think that there is a wind farm somewhere. It's not a tourist attraction, though, so I don't know exactly where it is, but I hear that there was something on like a 60 Minutes a number of years, several years ago, about it.
Well, I think it's interesting that you Ted, I think, had mentioned, or someone, that the author had actually never been there. And I get it, the plea not to just go as a tourist and take away the meaning of the area. But it feels to me like she would have had a special mission, a special reason to go. And perhaps if she had lost someone in her life, to try that and see, because what we're really hearing now, even though it exists, is her imagination. You know, if she hadn't been there, and who knows if you had gone there. I get it. It's not a nonfiction book. This is what it's like exactly to go there. But like even the caretaker who lived on the property, and how he interacted somewhat with the some of the people who came through, that was kind of a big part of it. And I wonder, does that really exist? Did she think to add it in? Because you've got a little bit of a human touch then too, beside just a phone booth, you know. It's I don't know. I'm just thinking out loud. I hadn't thought about that beforehand.
It's interesting.
Well, right. I think, you know, he wasn't just a caretaker. He was kind of a gatekeeper, because whoever came had to go through him, and in the process, you know, chat with him and his wife and get to know him. And he took what I thought were called meticulous notes about who had visited. And I thought maybe a bit about their background and that sort of thing. So that just occurred to me when you were saying what you were saying, that his role was very important, even mm-hmm. though he was just sort of, you know, taking care of the property so people could go to the phone. His role was greater than that.
So it makes me wonder, in the real one, is there such a person? It feels like there could be a good role for that, and I'd just be curious to know how it is, you know, if that sort of thing exists,
or whether she made that up. Yeah, good question.
Yeah,
whether
it's all made up.
I don't want to interrupt anyone. I'm sorry.
I'm sorry. I just made a comment that the whole thing could be made up. There may not be a phone there.
No, I think she said, in the end, she said there was.
There is one. Yeah.
Okay.
I was struck by, you know, some of the people that came there, like the young man on his bicycle that wanted to talk to his mother. And, you know, they were kind of mundane things, like, you know, I'm studying for exams and I'm trying to do a good job of it. And do any of you remember that?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Just kind of, you know, aren't those the things when we lose someone that we just love, you know, we think, oh, I wish I could share that with so-and-so, you know, pick up the phone or whatever. And, you know, and he sounded quite dedicated to doing that. Like, and he, you know, he was going to come back, and he did that often, it sounded like.
Was that the kid? Sorry, go ahead.
No, that's all right. Go ahead.
I'm not remembering very well. One of the young guys was trying to get into, I thought it was med school, and mm-hmm. Takashi helped him to make his application write, if not write, letters of recommendation. That was one story. And then the other one was names are escaping me, but Keiko or something like that, where his father had stopped speaking and communicating when they lost the mother, his wife, and the kid was going there on the phone to communicate with the mother, but about the father, right? And in the end, they convene or converge at the hospital, where Yui is from her injuries, but the father, I thought, was there as well, and he ends up talking, or the kid is the nurse there, and at that time, his father comes out of his whatever it was he was in and started talking and relating again. And that was, again, you know, a happiness that came from the book toward the end. But their coming together in that way was added to the book,
I thought. I wanted to, I remember, and I think it might be the book club, but I remember that we read a book. It was on a beach area, and they had a mailbox, and people left a letter, and then somebody else could come and read the letter. And do you remember any of that? I read a book like that, and I can't remember the name of it, but it kind of reminded me of the phone booth kind of thing, because it was when people were struggling, they would go to the mailbox. Mm-hmm. And they would write a letter there while they were there, and then they'd leave the letter and somebody else would find it. But I was struck by the fact that she didn't go into the phone booth. And I wondered why, you know, she went every week and she really found comfort in the garden. But later on, she explained that they found her mother and her daughter clasped together, and that she felt that because she was able to see them, that she had some closure and maybe didn't feel the need to go into the phone booth and talk to her mother. But it was interesting too that at the end, when she had some happiness, that she did go into the phone booth and started telling her mother, you know. And I thought that was really good too. I thought it was a great story.
The guy that was the caretaker of the garden, I don't remember from the beginning of the book, did he set the phone booth up? How did the phone booth come into existence?
He did, and that was his home. He lived there.
I knew that. I just couldn't remember if he bought the home and it was there or he set it up. I just didn't remember that.
He set it up, I think.
Okay. They never really delved into too much, like, I don't think, unless I missed it, how he got the idea to do that, because it's an unusual, you know, it's an unusual thought, an unusual thing to set up. I know because he lived very, very close to where the tsunami was, and there was a lot of loss and many people were grieving around him. What made him think, gee, perhaps a phone where they could talk, you know, might be helpful? Interesting.
Yeah, you're right. I wish they would have talked about that a little bit, of what inspired him to do that. I couldn't remember again if he set it up, but if he did set it up, where did that idea come from? And is there something like this someplace else in the world? You know.
And at first too, I mean, as crazy as this, I love the book, but the way it ended, you know, I mean, you could sort of see it coming as they were visiting together. And of course they were brought together by their grief and falling in love, and they got married. I felt it was a little part of me was a little disappointed that it was sort of a happy ending like that, kind of wrapping up. Okay, now she has a husband and another person, another child. And, you know, it might have been more interesting, although more of a struggle. How does someone go on without ever physically filling those gaps in their life? How do they mentally deal with that? But that's a whole nother book, you know? And then when I think about it, when people have lost someone, particularly a spouse or a child, many do remarry or many do have other children. And how do they work to that point to be able to do that and let go of the grief somewhat enough to be able to take that next step forward, you know? And so this was the group she chose to write about, you know, not the ones who had what I think might have even been a more difficult struggle.
To me, the whole book was the process of her
going
through the whole thing.
Yeah.
And, you know, the fact that she and the fellow would go every week and they just got to know each other. They were friends and they were supportive and they understood the losses that they each shared. And to me, that was a whole process of realizing that they could love each other, I think. And I was really happy with the happy ending.
But that worked out,
you know.
I was, but just with those thoughts passed through my mind.
But the struggle still at the end, you know, she went off. I feared that she was going to get cold feet and run away. She really was struggling with it because she had to make the commitment. One of the other discussion questions at the end of the book is why we think she went to the phone booth in the midst of the monsoon and risked her life to go check on the phone booth and I guess even help save it. And, you know, my thought was that, well, she had never got on the phone yet. And so she wanted to maintain that possibility in the future. That would be one reason she would have. But also the gravity of the issues surrounding her getting on the phone, you know, her mother and daughter, and I think relating her big jump in life that she was facing as well was part of that. So,
the issue of family is also another side note that I took was that, you know, it's important to have that family, and how you had a family, the tsunami took it away or other things took it away. And not then trying to reestablish a family. And one of the quotes that I wrote down also was, you know, what is the definition of a family? It's a small group established by marital, parental, and sibling relation. It is the basic unit of our social composition. You know, when I think about the book, it's like, well, you had family. Things happened, and now they worked in the second half of the book on creating new families, and because that's so important to our social composition. So I thought that was kind of a neat theme that was flowing through the book too.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah. One thing I found a little unbelievable was what a perfect guy Takeshi was. I don't think he committed any transgressions. You know, he didn't have his own whatever struggles he was having. He kind of kept them to himself, and he was a very giving, understanding guy, both to his daughter and to Yui. So really, is there really a guy out there like that?
You cynic.
Moi? I'm a guy. I know. Next one to no one, you know.
You could sort of say it on the flip side, too, about Yui. You know how... she kind of easily eased in with the daughter. Of course, she was very afraid of it. That, I think, was the reason for her hesitancy towards the end of the married. And she said, I'm afraid that somehow the daughter won't accept me or whatever. But, I'm glad, and I could picture it working that way. But it did feel like, I mean, as crazy as this sounds, of course, their main conflicts were her with what she's dealing with the memories of her mother, daughter, him dealing with, you know, the loss of his wife, but even more so what the daughter was going through. And we didn't see, I'm forgetting it, any conflict between them as a relationship grows. You know, was there no time when this didn't seem like a good idea to them, or were they really, felt that, what am I doing here? This is too soon, or who knows what. But, I guess, but then if she did all that and then the book was another 200 pages, we'd be saying, oh man, it's too long, and tighten it up a little and get to the point. So I guess you can only do so much. I don't know.
Speaking of the progression though, I was taken by, you know, on the one hand, she was all conflicted and was avoiding interactions with Takeshi and the daughter. And then like within half a page or so, they were married. It seemed like, the process went from, no, I ain't going to do this, to, you know, 2 weeks or so after the wedding or something. It just seemed like they left the wedding part out of the discussion. It was just then taken for granted and we're moving on. So that, I don't know, it caught my attention, and not in a good way.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, one other comment that I noted, actually just in thinking about it now, so he was a a doctor, and I thought he was a surgeon. I don't, maybe that's not right, but anyway, doctor, and she had this radio show, which, you know, both of which are extremely demanding careers. And although they mentioned her radio work, you know, fairly often, it wasn't like it dominated their lives, and his not at all. Like, he was able to live. So the complete focus was on their relationship and their going out to the phone and all this. And, you know, I had a career. We all had careers. And it usually takes a bigger toll on your life than they let on with these two, it seems to me.
Did it sort of describe, though, that they began going once a month?
It was always once a month, I think.
So right.
Yeah.
First, it was once a week.
Yeah, and then...
Then that went once a month after, I think, 2 years.
Oh, wow.
After 2 years. So I didn't remember that. Because I know it was several years before they got married and all of that, but...
I guess the author just really chose to focus on this relationship, you know, and how it sort of progressed through here. Because now that you think about it, you know, here she is on this radio show. She could have developed that a little bit more of how does she even get through that, the concept of going back to work in such a public job, and would she ever break down, you know, but it's so hard. You shouldn't do that in front of the public when you're on the radio. It felt like there could have been more aspects of their lives that they dealt with this grief. But I guess by just keeping it just with the interactions regarding the phone and bringing in these few other occasional characters, that was the purpose of it.
Her radio show was also was trying to help people that were having struggles. It was almost an Ann Landers type of thing, that you're helping people that have issues. Isn't that what her radio show was?
It may have evolved to that. Initially, it was just music. I thought she was more of a disc jockey.
Well, people called in, and the one
that's what I thought. I thought people called in and with issues for her to talk about. Yeah,
and. That's how she learned about this place. Someone called in and said that.
Oh. Well, wouldn't it have been interesting if she had had a few conversations of people calling in later on as the book developed, and, you know, memories of the tsunami or how things are going, and or another way of hearing about that person's grief. It just feels like there's all kinds of more paths that could have been explored.
But I wondered if it wasn't a cultural thing. She was writing from the Japanese culture. And I'm not sure that they are as, they wear their hearts on their sleeves like Americans do.
Right.
They didn't say anything about her telling about her experiences at the phone or at the place on her radio show for herself, just sharing that with her listeners.
Right.
I didn't hear anything about that.
Now, the author wasn't Japanese, was she Italian? Because at the very beginning it said, this book has been translated from the Italian. And I thought,
I think her husband was Japanese, because she spoke of her in-laws at the end, the acknowledgments, and the in-laws had Japanese sounding names.
And she lived in Japan. They lived in Japan.
Okay.
Yeah, Sharon, your comment reminded me how another nice aspect of the book was to be educated on some of the traditions. I mean, the language, the terms that she used were good, and I did find myself going back to the glossary at the back to find out how they were defined. But then also a lot of what I thought of as Western references, and like, you know, Hannah's painting her nails versus her daughter who would bite her nails, you know, and a lot of just, you know, modern references to life as we know it, they were experiencing too. So it brought it into this time of life, you know. So it's a modern book, but references to the traditions in the Japanese culture were also made. So it added to the value of the book.
The Dutch have a word called uitwaaien, which means standing in the wind. And you do this to connect to nature, and you use it to get emotional clarity and create a sense of well-being. And so as I was, I recall that this was a windy spot. And I was, so I thought of this Dutch word and this Dutch practice where you stand in the wind and sort of let everything release from your body. Mm-hmm. So I thought, well, the phone booth was, and being on this windy hill was sort of that practice of connecting to nature. And I saw the book as I think someone's used the word pilgrimage. I described it as a pilgrimage through grief and all the stages, and perhaps they weren't described as we might, or as Kubler-Ross would have described them, but it was a process. And those of us who have lost near and dear ones know that it is a process. And I talk to my mom all the time. Steve does the same with his parents who are gone. And it's the silly things. It's when I'm cooking.
That's not silly.
No. Mm-hmm.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
We go to my parents' gravesite, as well as Cindy's parents' gravesite, and then we talk to them like we're walking up and then saying hello. It was good to see you again. here's what we've been doing. So I guess we kind of do that. It makes us feel like we're actually visiting them rather than just looking at a gravesite.
I think I appreciate what you said about that. This is showing sort of this process that she went through. And I just want to say, when I gave that book to someone, it was way far from, when she lost her child. I don't think it's a book you'd hand to someone that just lost someone, but more has tried to go on with their life and incorporate a loss. And, it becomes a part of them how they're ultimately, faring in terms of reengaging with life, yet holding that. Anyway, and isn't it, it's called the wind phone.
Isn't it? Yeah.
I think that adds another aspect to it, is that, you're not just going up to a solid object and just talking into it. You're talking into it, and then the wind is carrying your words. They can carry them up to heaven, So I the fact that it's called the wind phone, I think, even adds to the feature quite a bit.
I agree.
And if you think about it, she, until she found out that they had found her mother and her daughter, the people that lost the people in the tsunamis had no grave, had no place that the bodies were. They were gone. They were taken out to sea. And how, if you think about when we have somebody die, we have a funeral. We have people come around and help you with your grief. And you have a period of extreme mourning right after they die, but it's still there and people talk about it. And here was a country that had lost so many people in such a tragic way. And I found it very interesting. I enjoyed reading it, and I agree with you, because my husband passed away a long time ago, and I still talk to him. I still talk to my parents. So yeah, but I think that the fact that without a funeral, without a body, I think it probably made a huge difference to these people.
No, I said, are you going to the store?
So. Anyway, I like the book.
I like the book very much.
I'm curious what the author's profession was, unless she's just a full-time author. The brief notes at the end, I don't think revealed that, or I don't remember anyway. what her background was. Anybody know that? Or I suspect
it says comparative studies from the University of Tokyo.
She taught?
She has a PhD in comparative studies from Tokyo University of Foreign Studies.
Yeah.
And right. lives in Japan with her husband and two children. But I think I thought it was the best descriptor was that it is a beautiful book.
It is.
Yeah.
I would agree with that.
I was going to say, too, that it is a hopeful book and very beautifully shown because it does show that process or that arc of grief in this particular case. And it really takes Yui from that point where she just doesn't know if it'll ever get better, if she'll ever smile again. And I think a lot of us have probably had that feeling before. We're just so caught up in it. And it takes some time and it takes some people coming into the frame she didn't know if she would ever recover, but then she does, even in the face of this unspeakable tragedy. It was really beautiful. Mm-hmm. I enjoyed it.
Marjorie, what did you like about it? You said you really liked it.
Oh, I feel like I can't talk without the book in my hand. I found it hopeful as well. And I don't know. I like anything with a garden in it and a phone in the garden. I just imagine it up on a high, high point overlooking. And I don't know if the description was there or not, but at the edge of a garden over kind of looking over the ocean. Mm-hmm. I just... It was a relaxing read, a joyful read. And I learned some things about the culture. And any of those things make a book a good read for me.
And it did have a beautiful cover, too, on at least the hardcover book.
Yeah, I mean, and the pages had, just like little pictures.
Yeah.
It's not showing up, but.
Because you're blurred in the background, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But I just think it's very, very nice.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, it also, it shows how people dealt with tragedy, too. I mean, that's another aspect of the book, and it brings different characters and different people, dealt with it, the tsunami and tragedies in a lot of different ways. Some not talking for a while, some trying to find a way to talk to their loved ones, other ones ignoring them completely. I mean, how do you, when something this bad happens, it's how do people help each other out, get through this? Lots of little different aspects of the book that just made it so interesting.
It was a very humane book.
I was struck by I think it was early on in the book when Yui found a little outfit that she had bought for her daughter or maybe a game or some toys, things that she was saving. And I think at the end of that chapter, the message was, I'm not going to live my life looking into the saving for the future. I'm going to live today and give my presence today.
I like the title, The Phone Booth at the Edge of the World. I just think mysterious kind of thing.
And that was not the original title, right? The original, they gave it to us in Italian and then translated it. And let me, is anybody, we'll see if we can find it here quickly.
Okay.
Hang on, I'm trying to do something else too. I mean, go ahead, I'll look for it here.
I mean, this would be another author that would be fun to talk to us. How did you put all these ideas together and blend them together so nicely?
Yeah.
Right.
If I may, so in the acknowledgments, she said to, well, she thanked two women, one named Laura. Laura, thank you for the title. The original Italian title is, I won't speak the Italian, but it translates in English to "What We Entrust to the Wind."
Oh,
ooh, I like that.
Wouldn't have been a bad title if you asked me. Yeah. But
I like the phone booth being in it.
Yeah, this is a little more provocative, I think.
Yeah.
I like the chapters were short, and some of them just had very little, you know, just a. If this is the right book, I've read a couple of books, but it's it had just maybe some sayings or just maybe one or two pages that she wanted to convey in that chapter to get to the next chapter. I like that. I've never seen a book written like that before.
Yeah.
Yeah, like I found the chapter where that Kita talks to his mother. I was mistaken about his studies, but you know, he's telling her he found some pretzels and churros and wrappers in his sister's pocket or whatever. But it's probably less than a full page of text. But, you know, it ends by saying, see you, I'll come back soon, I promise.
Yeah.
Oh, and feel free to eat whatever you like. I guess he must have left food.
Erin, did you get a chance to read the book?
No, I just picked it up from the library yesterday. And the librarian who checked it out for me said, what a beautiful cover. What you yeah. So, you know, I've read the flaps and a few pages and acknowledgments and things like that, but I haven't read the book. But I have read the summary on Google. So I look forward to reading it. It's just that I'm having such a problem because I get the books from the library. I don't want to buy any more because I must have what feels like a million books. Like so much fun and so tender.
Yeah. Yes.
Well, one of my friends said he never bought a book unless he gave one away.
You knew how many books I had given away.
I mean, this is a book to pass on. I mean, yeah. A lot of the books we read for the club, like one of the first ones was a cast book, Isabel Wilkerson. And, we also said we better give that to someone. Mm-hmm. You know, it's important to read. And, I think this is another one. I had actually, my daughter had it and she mailed it back to me. I had read it a few years ago, so I only reread part of it before this discussion. So, everything's not entirely fresh, but and you said your wife has it already and she's giving it to someone.
Yep. Yeah. It's already scheduled for three more people.
How often have you given the book to somebody and then gone out and bought yourself a new copy because you're sorry that it's
wanted it? Yeah.
You mean like of any book because you want one of your own?
Yeah.
I'm also trying to not, I'm like you, Karen. I think I probably have 1,000 books and I'm as we try to clean things out as we get older, I'm giving away. I find places like our clubhouse that collects books, so I donate them there. Our library allows you can give them to the library, and then they sell them for $1. And so there's a lot of things you can do. But there are some books that are just so good that I cannot part with them. And so I every year I keep probably a dozen more books and they add to the pile.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Room of the house. And this one has more than 1,000 in it.
Right.
I wonder, and as I have also been cleaning out some books, because I think it's very rare, and I wonder if other people actually reread books. I mean, sometimes I do if it's for a book club, and I read it a year or two ago, and I feel I need to reread it so I can participate in the discussion. But other than that, just because, oh boy, I really love that book, it always feels to me like, gosh, there's probably well, that probably there are hundreds, if not thousands or whatever, of books I haven't read yet. And, you know, rather than go back to the other one. So, and sometimes there might be comfort just seeing it every now and then on the bookshelf, but I'm trying to get away from that, from sort of the things sort of thing to just the process and the doing, you know, sort of thing, the reading and okay, I got it in my head and I've thought about it and now I move on. And, I don't know. Do any of you really reread books a fair amount?
Not a lot, but I find that when I get real disciplined and give them away, I need them.
Then you win. Yeah.
My other book group is reading Sula. I have taught Sula. Somewhere I had Sula, but I don't have it now. Shoot.
Yeah.
I have one bookcase that's just books by my friends and relatives.
Oh, my.
I cannot give any of them away.
No.
I would agree with that, yes.
Yeah.
Gosh. Or ones that you had autographed by somebody that I have trouble giving those away too. If I actually talked to the author and had them sign the book in front of me, I don't give those away either.
I managed to do that.
Now what I do hang on to, and occasionally we'll look back at, are if I go to interesting places, like years ago, I'd been in Amsterdam and went to the Anne Frank house and got a book, not the Diary of Anne Frank, but it was like a little, not travelogue sort of thing. It was like for a tourist to take home and remember. They have pictures of the staircase and little explanations of things. And, you know, so sometimes I like to look through those things or the Taj Mahal and just kind of remember that sort of thing. But that's not really books, you know, but it's just sort of stirring up memories of things. Yeah.
I don't know about those of you with grandchildren, but my grandchildren read on Kindle. So I have hundreds of children's books. And every now and then I send them a great big case of books, etc. But some of them will tell me, you know, I won't read it in that form.
Interesting.
Are there pictures on Kindle? Though, so, like, are they young enough to have like picture books? Could you see picture? You can't see pictures on Kindle. No. They must be older, not in the picture book age.
I don't know about the really little ones, but I have four who are avid readers who are older, 12, 14.
Oh, okay. Yeah, yeah. So that's regular books. Yeah. All right.
Yeah, they read Kindle. I don't know. So some I won't part with, even though they are children's books. I mean, I absolutely love pop-up books.
Oh, yes. Yes.
Problem.
I'm
with you on that.
I think I have to find a way to give them to my son for my baby granddaughter who's 5 months old, because otherwise I will keep them forever.
Yes.
Yeah.
I wonder if book clubs should do a book exchange or a book swap at one of the meetings. If you have books that you don't want, perhaps
that's a great idea.
Mm-hmm. One of my groups does that, and I came home with two more books. I'm now
need those.
I neither have time to read nor place to put. But okay.
A place to which I gave hundreds of books was the hospital. I was coordinator of volunteer services, and we used to have volunteers who took a library cart around, going room to room to visit with the patients and offer them reading materials and also coloring books and cards, playing cards and the like. Anyway, I loved giving them my books because I knew they would be given to people who were really in compromised situations, who appreciated getting books. We have to stop that during COVID. Mm-hmm. And in fact, there are no books or magazines now in the hospital waiting rooms, whereas they used to be jam-packed, and I could tell you which ones were in which waiting room throughout the Ann Arbor campus, including East Ann Arbor.
If Do you think they'll ever start that up again, Karen?
No, they're not starting it up again. They're so concerned about germs. And you know, and I know, how often do those COVID germs get transmitted through a book or something you touch? I think lots of people coughing and sneezing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
If you wanted to do that, at each of the UMRA meetings during the academic year, I do a summary of the shared interest groups, and I always tell people what book we read and what's coming up. If you wanted to get rid of the book that you, not get rid of, you want to share the book with somebody that at one of our meetings, bring it to the meetings, and I'll say, we read this book last month. If anybody wants a copy, I'm leaving it on the table here, and I'm sure somebody will take it home, and it's a good way to share a good story.
Or create a table, have a table at the summer picnic or the August picnic,
mm-hmm.
where you could just bring a book and people could browse. And
I've been to several places like that. And of course, I come home with more books.
Exactly right.
I think that's the flaw in your plan, Sharon, to have a book exchange, because most of us don't want them. We want to give them. And so it's a one-way street to a large extent.
I actually gave a ton of books and magazines to, for one thing, I'm forgetting its name. I can't believe it. This home for women who've been through domestic violence.
Alpha House?
Safe House? Alpha House.
Safe House. It's Safe House.
Safe House. And I've taken tons to the Eisenhower Center.
Mm.
The Eisenhower Center is for people with neurological impairments, and those are greatly appreciated.
Hmm.
So lots of them.
Yes.
I like looking at the books at the Kiwanis. Sometimes I go into the Kiwanis sale, you know, it's just Friday and Saturday, I think. And I always gravitate over to that area. And you know, sometimes I'll even buy a book that I read so I could maybe give it to one of my daughters or a friend or something. But I found some for myself. So I found Monica Starkman's book. I remember something.
By the way, if you're thinking of Safe House, where they're greatly appreciated, something else I've donated there, you may have to donate, which is pictures, framed pictures for your walls, etc. Because after those people have left their homes under horrendous situations, generally, they are then moved to homes, and they love having the pictures. And at the university, also at Michigan Medicine, as it used to be called. We also had tons of pictures through the Gifts of Art program, and we'd take those around to patients' rooms and offer them the opportunity to select a picture for their room. And then the time came, they decided to retire lots of pictures, and I took them to Safe House, because Safe House was glad to give them to the people who were then to be newly housed.
Interesting.
Beautiful,
Karen. Thank you for telling me that. Mm-hmm. You know, I have a lot of artist paintings in my artist group, and there might be some people that have some that they would like to donate. Okay.
Great. I think most of these people might have difficulty buying frames or getting them framed.
They would need to be framed.
Yes, if they can be put up. Would be preferred.
Right.
I'm going to stop our recording now, unless we have
more to say
about the book, only because this is posted as a podcast, and we're a very eclectic group, so I'm going to stop the recording.
Okay.